This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia. This week, but first.
Harper Lee had the kind of success most writers can only dream about. Shortly after her novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, came out in the summer of 1960, it hit the bestseller lists. Then it won a Pulitzer Prize, and then was made into an Oscar-winning movie. Her novel has never gone out of print.
But in a move that's unheard of in this age of celebrity writers, Lee stepped out of the limelight and stopped doing interviews years ago. She has never written another book. Still, her influence has endured. As we mark the 50th anniversary of its publication, NPR's Lynn Neary examines why this novel has had such a lasting effect on our culture.
On the last day of school at T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia, 10th graders straggle into English class for their final exam. Teacher Laurel Taylor stands at the door, reminding this plugged-in generation that they won't be taking the test on a computer.
Yeah, I'm going to collect it. Do you have a pen or pencil with you? You need to get one. Go find a friend.
The world these kids were born into is so different from the way things were 50 years ago when To Kill a Mockingbird was published. Harper Lee's story of Scout Finch and her father Atticus, who defends a black man unjustly accused of rape, came out just as the fight to desegregate schools was getting started. Today, kids of all races sit in Taylor's classroom, and she says many come from all over the world.
And yet they all still find something in that book that kind of resonates. I think that sense of kind of trying to find your identity and realizing that your society doesn't always tell you the right thing and that sometimes you have to go against what everyone else says to do the right thing, all that kind of resonates no matter where you come from.
Taylor first read To Kill a Mockingbird as a student teacher, and her passion for it is still fresh. She nudges her students to talk about the book, asking them what they learned from it. Chachi Wesson-Segett shyly offers this.
I learned that you shouldn't just say you don't like a certain person based on their culture or skin color or race.
Was there any one character that you kind of liked best?
Scout.
Why?
She spoke her mind and, like, she wasn't afraid of anything.
Mohamed Cisse says his favorite character is Atticus.
He's the only character in the book who is, like, willing to do the right thing, even though he will get a bad name for it. Because a lot of characters in the book, like, wouldn't even dare do that.
When asked whether this book, or any other book for that matter, could change a person's mind, Muhammad says no.
Like, there's still some people right now in this world, like, who still hate black people or hate another race. And I don't think their opinion is going to change just because of a book.
But when To Kill a Mockingbird came out, the world was changing. The Civil Rights Movement was underway, and in 1960, the same year the book was topping bestseller lists, black protesters tried to sit down at whites-only lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina. The racism they were battling was so deeply ingrained, it was simply a way of life.
They come in, and they sit down, and we're not used to them sitting down beside us, because I wasn't raised with them, I never have lived with them, and I'm not going to start now.
Joanne Gabin, now a professor of English at James Madison University in Virginia, grew up in the 50s and 60s. She was just a child when she saw a photograph of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American who was viciously murdered after he supposedly whistled at a white woman.
I was traumatized as a child by the whole thought of racism and the fact that children weren't safe in this country. And they weren't safe not because they were bad children. They were not safe because of the color of their skin. So for me, this was a pivotal book.
Gabin read the book at the age of 17. In Tom Robinson, the black man unjustly accused of rape, she saw not a victim, but a hero. He reminded her of her father and grandfather, black men who put up with untold humiliation in order to take care of their families. Atticus Finch gave her hope that there really were white people who would do the right thing. And she believes the book may have helped to make that happen.
I think those people who were determined to keep black people down and other people of color down in this country were not going to be reading this book in the first place and were not going to be influenced. But I think those people who were moderate, who were more liberal, when they got to read To Kill a Mockingbird, they probably wanted to identify with the courageous character of Atticus Finch.
When the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird came out, Atticus became permanently entwined with the actor who portrayed him, Gregory Peck. But whether you first encountered him on page or on screen, Atticus was unforgettable. A modest man of great integrity, he managed to impart his wisdom without being too preachy.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town.
The relationship between Atticus and his 6-year-old daughter, Scout, is the emotional heart of the book. And for many girls and women, feisty, fearless Scout is the most memorable character. One such woman is Mary McDonough Murphy.
The story of Scout's initiation and maturing is the story of finding out who you are in the world. And at the same time, the novel is about who we are as a country.
Murphy's new book, Scout, Atticus, and Boo, is based on interviews about To Kill a Mockingbird with well-known writers, journalists, historians, and artists. Murphy says the novel, told from a child's point of view, gave white people, especially in the South, a non-threatening way to think about race differently.
I think the way the book is structured, with all these indelible characters, that the ending is not this kind of triumphant good over evil, Tom Robinson is acquitted. I mean, there's real moral ambiguity to what happens. It all combined to allow them to really question the moral order of things.
The questions raised by the book were part of a conversation that echoed around the country. It's a conversation that's still going on. And the book endures, says Mary McDonough Murphy, because people can relate to it in so many different ways.
It's about race. It's about prejudice. It's about childhood. It's about parenting. It's about love. It's about loneliness. I mean, there's something for everyone in its way, and it's a transforming experience.
To Kill a Mockingbird didn't change everyone's mind, but it did open some, and it did make an impression on many young people who, like Scout, were trying to get a grip on right and wrong in a world that's not always fair. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Assemble ye minions at the nearest Cineplex this weekend for the new animated 3D film, Despicable Me. It's the story of a very mean man who wants to become the world's top supervillain and the three orphans who melt his heart of stone.
You will not cry, or whine, or laugh, or giggle, or sneeze, or burp, or fart.
So no annoying sounds, right?
Does this count as annoying?
The main character is called Gru, and the actor who provides his voice is TV and movie star Steve Carell. He's in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
When you first read Gru's character, what did he sound like to you?
He sounded very similar to how he ended up. He had an accent to me, I couldn't really tell what sort of accent, and I don't think anybody can actually determine what accent I'm doing in the movie, which was my choice, of course. But I thought the character had a bit of an accent and should sound threatening without being overwhelmingly so.
Yeah. The voice kind of flows between the Count or Boris Badenoff, or sometimes I would hear Alan Arkin in The Russians Are Coming.
Oh, one of my favorite. I might have sort of subconsciously been channeling him. One of my favorite performances ever.
Everybody should get from street.
Get from street.
Throughout the movie, it's kind of like a running gag. You have to say, as Gru, light bulb.
Light bulb. My son, who is 6, saw the movie, and we'll be watching TV or doing something, and he'll lean over and say, "Daddy, say light bulb." He just loves that word. He loved the way I said it in the movie.
It's wonderful because it's just, you know, I've got an idea, but just in that one word, light bulb. You do have kids. I mean, to a certain extent, you make movies like these for them. I mean, you know, Dad, the big star now. And
sure, it's fun. You know, and I know it's kind of a cliche at this point when actors do movies like this and they say, well, I did it to be cool in my kids' eyes and something for them. But I think even more than that, I was taken by the story. I just thought it was a a very simple and beautiful story, and the animators are exceptional. It's a it looks different, and I just thought it was I like to do things that could potentially be entertaining or fun or whatever.
Yeah,
moving. And this seemed to be that.
And then the little kids. I mean, you've got these three little adorable animated orphans. Oh, please. I mean, and, you know, residences of Miss Hattie's orphanage and Little Orphan Annie. I mean, how can you not melt your heart?
It does. And I think there's something for, you know, because there's that side of it. The three little girls are orphans. But I think the little boys who go to see the movie are going to enjoy all of the techno gadgets and the big spaceship chases. And, you know, there's a science fiction element to it as well that I think is really fun.
So what are those little yellow creatures? I mean, they're minions, although you can't say the word. But they look like, you know, allergy pills running around in farmer overalls.
That I actually like that description, and from here on out, I will describe them as such. They are. I have to say, I've done some promotion for this movie, and everywhere I turn, there are the minions. Mm-hmm. There are minions at the premiere. There are minion dolls. There are minion inflatable balloons. The minions have become, I think, a cottage industry at this point.
They have. I mean, they've been a crawl on my television set for the last 2 months. We knew this movie was coming out.
You know what? They totally creep up on you. And whether you want to like them or not, you will like them by the end of this movie.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. You're famous for your role on television, Michael Scott, manager of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And you've decided to leave the character behind and move on.
I have. Seven seasons. My original contract was for seven seasons, and I plan on fulfilling my contract and then moving on after this next year.
And just because the show's in syndication now?
No, actually, you know, it's funny. I've been questioned, and I was really surprised that this even caused any sort of stir.
Are you kidding, Michael Scott?
No,
we love you.
I'm not. It really did surprise me, because I look at the show as a great ensemble show, and I look at my departure as just one piece of that ensemble going off, and I have no doubt the show will continue and be incredibly strong. But I'm choosing to move on specifically because of family. I have two little kids. I'd like to be able to enjoy a bit more of their childhood while they're still children.
I have three scenarios for Michael Scott's leaving. He leaves to become Jim and Pam's Manny.
Mm-hmm.
He moves to Florida with a new corporate owner played brilliantly by Kathy Bates.
Mm-hmm.
Or he reunites with Holly and lives happily ever after.
I would preferably go with number three. That would be my choice.
Oh.
I think it would be nice for the character to find happiness. And I think in terms of love and a family, that's ultimately what he's wanted the entire time. That's, I think, his driving force, is to be part of a family. And I think that's the kind of life that he's tried to create for himself at Dunder Mifflin. And he's really utilized the staff there as his family, because he doesn't have anything like that in his personal mm-hmm. life. And I think if he were able to find happiness apart from the office in a soulmate, who I think would be Holly, because she's the one woman that truly got him.
Yeah.
And it was understandable why. She saw the good in him. She saw all the positives, and the negatives did not matter to her.
Do you get any say in the matter?
In terms of how it ends?
Yeah.
I think some. Yeah, I'm a producer on the show, so I'm going to definitely put my two cents in.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'd like it to end in a subtle way, too. I don't want it to be this big sort of celebration or blowout. I want it to be... My favorite episodes are the ones that are kind of small and subtle and examine the mundane. And so I would love it if it kept away from being a big, ratings bonanza sort of episode. I just think that would be more appropriate and more logical and realistic, that people leave offices all the time for various reasons. And I would like it to just be kind of a subtle reason that he takes off.
And Angela can make some cake for the conference room, yes?
Yes. Yes. If she is still party planning chairman.
That's
we'll see what
happens. She and Phyllis have been arguing.
Yeah, they've been splitting the duties. That's a turmoil there.
Do you think you're going to continue to gravitate toward comedies, or do you harbor some deep wish to do tragedy?
You know, I think about that, and I think part of my problem is that I don't want to appear pretentious. I don't want to be the guy who mostly does comedies but then says, I need to show everybody my dramatic chops and what I can do and what I'm capable of, because I don't think that's a good enough reason to do something. I don't want to do it in order to prove to someone else that I'm capable of it. It just doesn't seem like a valuable reason to pursue something. That being said, yeah, I mean, I'd love to do other different things, but I love to do comedy too. And I think I'll always try to base whatever I do on what would potentially be good, what I might enjoy doing, who I might be working with. But I'm actually looking at doing a more dramatic movie with Jay Roach, of all people, who directed Dinner for Schmucks, and he also directed Recount. And so he kind of can play on both sides as a director, the drama or the comedy. So that might be something in the works right now.
Well, it's good to know you have some jobs lined up, Steve.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep busy.
Actor Steve Carell, he is the voice of Gru, the evil villain, in the new 3D animated movie Despicable Me, which opened this weekend. He joined us from New York. Steve, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can hear more from our conversation with Steve Carell at npr.org.
A hilly neighborhood of Los Angeles known as Echo Park is the subject of a debut novel by author Brando Skyhorse. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco spent an afternoon with Skyhorse visiting his old haunts. They're the setting for his book, The Madonnas of Echo Park.
I met up with the 36-year-old writer on a stretch of Sunset Boulevard that cuts through Echo Park.
Well, let's start with your name, Brando.
Yeah, that was my mother's idea. She named me Brando because of Marlon Brando's involvement in Native American activities in the early 70s. You know, he turned down the Academy Award. You know, she decided she was going to name me Brando as sort of an homage to him. And I realized she was just really a big fan of The Godfather.
Brando says his late mother was very involved in the American Indian movement in the 1970s. Even though she'd been born Mexican American, he says his mom identified as Native American.
She got in contact with a man who was incarcerated, and his last name was Skyhorse, and I became Brando Skyhorse. My mother changed her name as well, and she became Running Deer Skyhorse.
It wasn't until later that he learned his biological father had abandoned the family when Brando was 3. Paul Skyhorse was just one in a series of stepfathers. Brando's true identity was just one of the enigmas that set him apart in Echo Park, a predominantly Mexican-American neighborhood, a working-class area that was once a backdrop for many silent movies.
The Keystone Cops used to film their first shorts, you know, here in Echo Park. Tom Mix, Charlie Chaplin, you know, they had these fantastic mansions up in Angelino Heights.
When the film industry moved on to nearby Hollywood, Echo Park eventually changed. There was white flight. Then in the 1970s and 80s, Skyhorse grew up here surrounded by Vietnamese and Mexican immigrants. At the time, Echo Park was known for drive-by shootings.
I was definitely the nerdy kid with the book bag, with the glasses and the whole thing. I didn't hang out with gangs or anything like that. I don't think I even considered it an option because, like, I just wasn't cool enough for that. I wasn't even worthy enough to, like, be hassled by them. I was just totally invisible.
But Skyhorse's outsider status helped him develop an observer's eye for the people he, his grandmother, and mother encountered.
You know, I think what I was exposed to was the working class element of Echo Park that you don't see in books or movies because it's not as glamorous. I mean, okay, who wants to read a book about somebody going to clean houses all day? Well, that's, you know, interesting to me.
So in his novel, one of Skyhorse's protagonists is a housekeeper who works in the Hollywood Hills. She and other characters are based on some of the people Skyhorse met while growing up in Echo Park.
There were all these sort of, like, you know, weird cast of characters just kind of around the neighborhood. And there was this one elderly lady who used to wear a turban and this lime green coat walking up and down the neighborhood. And for some reason, she always, like, stopped at our house because I guess my grandmother was very chatty. And she always stopped by at, like, you know, 1 in the morning, pound on the door and say, like, you know, this is the police, open up.
In Sky Horse's novel, she becomes a woman who wears many coats. And in one scene, she encounters the Virgin Mary at a bus stop on Sunset Boulevard.
It's left up to you to decide whether is what she's doing is actually having a hallucination, or whether she's crazy, or whether she's actually experiencing a miracle that people just are ignoring.
Among others who populate Sky Horse's book are an undocumented day laborer, a recently paroled hustler, and a little girl named Alma. He calls them all Madonnas.
Because every single character is interested in reinvention, becoming more than what you have been told you can become, being more than what you think you're capable of being.
I met some real-life girls from Echo Park, 16-year-olds Brenda Marones, Yesenia Pum, Ana Rivas, and Michelle De Leon. They're writers with the group 826 LA. I asked them to read aloud the central scene from The Madonnas of Echo Park.
Alma used to dance with her mother outside El Guanaco, a mercado near Angelino Heights that sold rock-hard Twinkies, Colt 45s, and homemade tacos and burritos in the back. She and a half-dozen other girls and their mothers gathered there on the corner spontaneously. Then every Friday afternoon, when I recognized El Guanaco in Madonna's music video, Borderline.
In the video, Madonna dressed as a classic lowrider chola in a 40s-style hair bonnet, white wife beater, long draped coat, and baggy pants that came up to her waist. A short distance away, we heard the sounds of sirens and gunfire.
5 loud gunshots in quick succession. Not firecrackers or popping corn, but deep hammer thrusts. Cut the fleshy air.
Alma was lying on the ground. We all thought she'd fallen and scraped her knee, or was playing dead the way little children do all the time in the barrio. When her mother turned her on her side, blood poured out a small hole in front of her neck.
The next day, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner ran a front page picture of Alma in a torn Madonna t-shirt with the banner headline, Baby Madonna Murdered by Heartless Thugs.
Brando Skyhorse says this is the sort of scenario that used to happen all the time when he was growing up.
You know, there would be like a young little girl, she'd be in the wrong place in the wrong time, and, you know, she'd be killed. And there would be this public outcry, and they'd look for the killer, and the killer was never found.
And Skyhorse says he remembers some of the early Madonna videos were shot in the area, the ones where she still looked like a chola, a homegirl from around the way.
There was this discussion that, like, there's this young, attractive Mexican girl who was, like, you know, a pop star, and, like, you know, why is she singing in English? And then, of course, later it came out that she wasn't, but I don't think the people in my neighborhood at least cared. It didn't matter. It was like that was the initial impression, and there was not going to be anything that, like, changed them or dissuaded them from thinking otherwise.
Skyhorse says that memory sparked his interest in revisiting the neighborhood long after he left to go to the acclaimed writing program at the University of California, Irvine, and eventually to become a book editor in New York. The real-life Echo Park girls say he painted a realistic portrait of their hood.
He's trying to show the Latino story of Echo Park.
Would you consider yourselves the Madonnas of Echo Park?
Of course. It's kind of good to, you know, to be like the story. It kind of makes me feel proud to live in Echo Park.
Brando Skyhorse is now working on his next novel, a memoir about growing up with 5 stepfathers. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block, thinking back almost 40 years to a needle dropping onto vinyl and this voice.
I feel the earth move under my feet. I feel the sky tumbling down.
For me, it was Carole King first. James Taylor got me later.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you.
Carole King and James Taylor were playing together on those albums from the early 70s, King on piano, Taylor on guitar, and now they've reunited.
We love you, too.
We do. We love you.
Honest to goodness.
They're near the end of a concert tour, filling arenas around the country. Carole King is 68 now. James Taylor is 62.
He says goodnight to moonlight ladies. Drop off my sweet Navy James.
It's called the Troubadour Tour for the club in Los Angeles where Carole King and James Taylor first played together in 1970 and where they discovered just how well they blended.
It was an amazingly good fit. It just felt very familiar and as if we were twins separated at birth or something.
And I have to share with you, when James said that about, you know, separated twins, I just looked at him because I had just had that exact thought. Because it is like when, you know, the blend that the Everly brothers have or family members who sing and play together, that's in their DNA. To our knowledge, we don't share DNA, but it feels as if we do.
But we really do share very much a sort of musical vocabulary, or our tastes and tendencies musically are very parallel.
What is that vocabulary, do you think?
Well, there are some things about it that you could mention. We like the same kind of suspended chords. We have a similar way of sort of voice leading. Given a melody line, we tend to harmonize it in a similar way. We tend to, you know, there are a lot of suspended fourths that we like to use. It's just remarkable how in step we are.
Very really much.
Tonight, the light of love is in your eyes. But will you love me tomorrow?
Well, take me back 40 years to those first shows at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. You've talked before, James, about first hearing a song at the Troubadour that would become a huge hit for you,
yeah,
Carole King song.
My only number one hit that I so far was You've Got a Friend, and I've traveled around the world on that song and played it for audiences over and over again. And it never grows tired for me. I always make a connection with the tune, and I'm brought back to that moment at the Troubadour when I stood outside the dressing room, which was on the balcony, and looked down at Carole playing her set on the stage below. And as soon as I heard the tune, and I heard it the first time I think it was played in public, to me it was so compelling musically. I had to play it. I had to get to a guitar. I was desperate to get to my guitar and just wander through those changes and sing that song.
You just called out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again.
I can tell you from sitting in the audience at the arena here in Washington that, you know, not just on You've Got a Friend, but on just about any song you play, Sweet Baby James, Blossom, all the way through, you know, if you tip your head back, you're just surrounded by this cathedral of voices singing along with you. And I wonder if you're thinking about the people in the audience, thinking back to the moments of their life where these songs were everything, where they really were the fabric of a certain point in their lives.
Here's what's interesting to me about that. Yes, we are thinking about that because we can feel that, and it's just sort of one consciousness. But the thing that I continue to find astonishing, and increasingly so as this tour builds momentum, is the number of people for whom it was not the soundtrack of their lives. It was the soundtrack of their parents, and in some cases, grandparents' lives.
Just call out my name.
James, do you think about sort of that shared experience, what people are thinking as they're listening to these songs again?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a live performance is you know, music has become sort of ubiquitous. You listen to it in the car, you listen to it on your iPod when you're on the treadmill, you listen to it in the frozen foods and in the doctor's waiting room. But when you go to a concert, that's time that you have put aside and focused on the music. And it really is a, you know, we joke and say, you know, to the audience, we're glad you came, it's not the same without you. But really, you know, it's like going to church for Carol and me. I mean, a lot of it is celebratory and some of it is, you know, irreverent and irrelevant, but it's very uplifting. And it's the thing that keeps you coming back, that keeps you, you know, on the road and touring.
Does it feel, you've done a number of these shows now, not just this year, but going back, I guess it started in 2007 at the Troubadour for the reunion. Do you get a sense of an end point that, okay, we've done this and it was wonderful and now we're done and it's time to move on?
Well, there is an end point. Our last show scheduled is July 20th in Anaheim. And, I mean, we knew that it had to be finite. I think a special thing stops being special when you go on doing it and doing it and doing it. Yeah. It is going to be over.
You know, Carol and I talked about it a few times, and Carol said to me something I'll never forget. She said, you know, not only do you not want to stay too long at the ball for the audience, but you want, not only do you want to leave the audience wanting more, you want to leave yourself wanting more.
Well, Carol King and James Taylor, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you.
It's really, really been a pleasure.
And if this old world starts again,